Well, good evening, everybody. The doctor isn't quite in the house, but his son has arrived tonight. So it's my pleasure to welcome you here to Latimer Congregational Church. My name is Paul Walker. I'm one of the deacons here. And to welcome you to our Son of Doctor Who evening. Without further ado, I'd like to introduce the Reverend Ian Clements. He's our minister here. And Reverend Mark Troughton, who will be conducting an interview. So I hope you enjoy it, and I'll hand over to Ian and Mark.
Great, thanks, Paul. I need the mic.
Great, well, thank you. For coming, and thank you very much, Mark, for coming to be with us. Really, the plan for this evening is just to have a bit of an interview to kind of go through your life and some of your reminiscences of your father. There'll be some, obviously, conversation about Doctor Who and other things as we go. There'll be time for question and answers at the end, so if there are any burning things that I don't cover, then feel free to raise your hand at the end and we can ask. Ask Mark. I can't promise that Mark will answer.
Yeah, no, I can't either.
but that's what we'll do. As we go, we have some pictures and some clips that we'll see on the screen as we move the conversation forward. Now, I'm going to begin in a moment, just the start of your life, but just so that we know, the kind of point we're going to get to in the conversation, I wonder if you could tell us a little bit about your family and what you do now. Not in a huge amount of detail, we'll cover that later, but just...
Okay, family, present family.
Immediate family, and... Yeah.
Okay, so we moved up to York and Yorkshire back in 2004, so we've been here 14 years now, and... before that, we were in Switzerland for 9 years, working with French-speaking churches around Lake Geneva, so out of Lausanne, and then in the Alps in Martigny. And prior to that, I was co-pastoring a church in Bedford. So we've been sort of based in the UK mostly, a bit of time in Switzerland, and now back here. And yeah, I'm pastoring the church, York Evangelical Church, in York. So I'm married to Jane, and we have six, four still at home. One is now married, and expecting her first in July, which is lovely. And Eleanor's at university, Tom is at university, Eleanor's in York, so she's at home. And then there are three other girls as well, so five girls and a boy. Plus my wife, so 6 years ago we're a bit outnumbered at home. Yeah, it's nice to get out from time to time. Yeah.
That's great. Well, we'll come to what you're doing now towards the end of the interview, but let's go back to perhaps the start of your life. When and where were you born?
So I was born in Paddington Hospital in West London, and that was in 1959, so you can work out how old I am. Dad and Mum settled in a small bungalow in a little suburb of London called Kew, which is about half an hour's walk from Kew Gardens. So a very pleasant part of London. Dad was a great gardener, and the reason why he bought the bungalow was because it had a 100-foot lawn with a garden, and he loved roses, so he was a great rose gardener, and small bungalow which he sort of extended over the years. So he loved did a lot of DIY, not always brilliantly, but it's still standing. And so I grew up in Kew, went to school locally on Kew Green, and then secondary school just up the railway line into London in Hammersmith. A direct grant grammar school, as it was then. Still there, still going strong. I go back occasionally. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Great. And brothers, sisters?
Yep.
What was like about the age of five or six?
Dad had a very colourful life, in not very good ways always. He was married three times, so through his first wife, Margaret, he had a girl and two boys. Through mum, a girl and two boys. And then he married a third time, a widow who already had two grown-up children. So, so I have a brother, Peter, who's still living in London, and a sister, Jane, who's in the States. So we're fairly spread out, yeah.
Right. And you've already begun to answer that this a little bit in terms of the gardening and DIY, but just give us a snapshot of some of your memories of your father as a kind of small child, I guess, you were under 10. I suppose 5 or 6, thinking kind of pre-Doctor Who, I guess. So the kind of
pre-Doctor Who. Oh gosh.
Kind of not connected. To
can
Doctor
I sort
Who,
of creep into yeah. the beginning yeah. of Doctor Who? Because that I would have been very young, sort of pre-Doctor Who. So Dad was. As you probably know, he was a theatre actor, so he did all his training in a theatrical repertory company, or REP, as they're called, in Amersham. And he then got jobs mostly touring in the theatre and did the usual sort of classical plays that you'd expect, someone to do. So the Shakespeare's and the Ibsen's and the Chekhov's, that sort of thing. And then this newfangled thing called TV kicked off sort of in the 1950s, black and white TV, with a dot, when you turned off the television. Dad began to, obviously saw this as the new medium that was going to really take off and become the orthodoxy, which of course it has, and was the very first Robin Hood on BBC TV in 1957, I think it was. You may have a photograph of it.
Yeah, yes.
that's a very typical 50s, sort of post-war shot of Dad.
Do you know what led your father to go into acting? Do you know what prompted that?
I think a bit of a black sheep decision, really, because his dad was in Lloyd's Shipping Insurance, and I think his grandfather was also in, he was either in a legal profession or in some sort of insurance. So I think Dad was the first to break that mould and go into acting, which was probably frowned upon, and he was probably warned that he would, be poor for the rest of his life, the usual stuff. But he did it, and was very blessed, actually, all the way through, right from the early days. And one of the first roles he landed was with another contemporary actor, Laurence Olivier. You may have heard of him, Sir Laurence Olivier, as well, acting in Richard III, and that took him to the States, to New York, where they filmed some of it over there. And got off to a very good start, really. And then, as I say, television became sort of the next big thing. And I remember distinctly the day when he was offered the part of Doctor Who. I'll come to that later.
Yes. Great. Okay. Thanks, Paul.
We can recap for you.
Yes. Well, in some ways, as an interview, it's kind of helpful to have that baked. You were racing through some of the things that I wanted to slow down and chat. So, as a child, when was your first awareness of what your father did for a living? Was there a moment when you saw your father at work, either on a stage or on TV or on a film, and thought, "Well, that's my dad," but he's not being my dad?
Yeah, I think Robin Hood was probably the first.
Right.
I guess Doctor Who was the first sort of real sense that, Dad's an actor and he's quite famous, because this is obviously, quite a big program every Saturday.
Okay.
I would have been, what was I? I would have been 7. Yeah.
Great. Well, come on, so some Doctor Who things in a minute. Now, as you said, he kind of performed alongside some famous actors. I think we've got some pictures. I think that's from a version of Hamlet he was in. I may be wrong. Yeah, and certainly that was Richard III.
Yeah, he's looking at Laurence Olivier. He's just been told to go and assassinate the twins in the town. Yeah.
Right. Working alongside Laurence Olivier, was there a lot of conversations in the household about kind of actors that he'd worked with, actor friends, any kind of anecdotes of the business part of growing up, or was it a case of it was a job that he kind of left at the door coming in to be a father? And to
half and half, really. It's not quite like, you know, if you ever asked Dad, so Dad, what did you actually do in the war? You know, he probably wouldn't go into tons of detail because, it, you know, people didn't, did they? I mean, they don't. It's just too traumatic, sometimes too painful. I guess there was a sense in which he would try and just sort of shut the door and leave it all behind, because it's a very, very intense type of lifestyle. Mm. You're out early, you know, location or going to London to rehearse or to film. If it's live, which a lot of it was live in the early days, that's pretty intense. You know, you have to sort of make sure you're getting it right, you know, dead on cue. You can't just sort of muck it up and then say, that's okay, we'll run it again, we've got plenty of film.
Yeah.
One of the things about the lost episodes of Doctor Who, the reason they're lost is because they overdubbed the film they used. So they would record on reel, and then that may be the first 10 episodes, and then episodes 11 to 20, they would use the same reels and just go over them, you know, to save money, which is a great shame, obviously, for, you know, people who are desperate to see those lost episodes. Mm. But, you know, everything was, I guess, on an extremely tight budget. The sets, you know, it's well known that sometimes the sets would wobble, you know. That was because, obviously, this was in the days before they had computer graphics, etc. But it did, you know, not exactly a shoestring budget, because obviously once it took off and really became popular, then more money started coming in. But I was still, you know, quite young. Later on in my teens, I would, you know, chat to him about, so what was it like working with X, Y, and Z? And then the best thing of all was when Dad would say, it's half term next week, or it's the Easter holidays, would you like to come to the studios and watch me film? You know, it's like, not really. yeah! So that was awesome. So that was all in, Doctor Who was all filmed in studio at the BBC TV Centre, which was in Wood Lane. Mm. So that's London. It's all now moved up to Manchester. So that huge crescent-shaped building where they did everything BBC, you know, so Blue Peter, Dad's Army, Tomorrow's World, The News, Panorama, The Lot, was all there. And there were studios that were just given over to certain films or series. So there was a Doctor Who studio. And that was just, yeah, an amazing experience. So you'd come up to off the main road through the gates, and Vic, the one-armed guard, I think he was blind in one eye, and he had one arm. I mean, you know, I think he was taken on because he looked so intimidating, you know. And so Vic would be standing there at the door and at the gate, you know, to check who you were, whether you could go in or not. And of course, he'd see Dad and he'd say, "Nice to see you, Mr. Troughton, in you go." And so we go and park and then go into the reception area. And it was like a who's who. I mean, you'd be walking into reception and then, you know, Raymond Baxter would walk past you tomorrow as well. And then you go down the corridor and, oh, it's Valerie Singleton, you know, Peter Burns, or it's John Noakes. Or one lunchtime, so we stopped for lunch, went to the canteen, which was sort of attached to a large bar area, and Dad's Army were in the bar, you know, all in their kit, just having a pint and having a break from rehearsals. You know, John Laurie and the lot off on the John Le Mesurier. It's like, oh my word, it's that Zami. You know? so that's just, it's just also, it's just amazing because there's like, occasionally you see people who you don't recognize because they're, you know, they're directors or assistant floor managers or makeup artists or whatever. But that makes it all the more fun because suddenly, you know, any moment a door will swing open, it'll be bang, you know, gulp. So that was tremendous.
Right.
And going into the studio was just like going into Ali Baba's cave because you'd have to wait until the light went turned from red to yellow to green. It had a lighting system outside, so you couldn't go in obviously when they were filming because you'd interrupt. So when the light was green, you could go in. So you'd go in. It was like going through an airlock. So there were like double doors, and suddenly from the light, you went into pitch black. So you went into this sort of darkness, and then your eyes adjusted, and you emerged from behind all the scenery, and suddenly this vast studio appeared with cables and huge cameras and. And then, you know, just lots of very, very bright lights shining on whoever, whatever was going on. And, that was tremendous. And once there was, there were a couple of Daleks just sort of standing there. And one had its lid off. And of course, you go over to it and you want to see what's inside, don't you? I looked at Dad and I said, is it okay if I get in? And he said, yes, I'm so, don't fall down.
So I couldn't resist, so I climbed inside the Dalek and popped the lid back on.
And it was very disappointing. I mean, it really did look like something that Blue Peter had, you know, knocked up out of a squeezy bottle and a few cereal packets. I mean, it was cardboard on the inside, a hardboard. The plunger was literally a sink plunger with the thingy bob. And then you had the ray gun, which went in and out, but didn't actually fire or do anything, because that was all electronics, obviously. And then it was just a hard seat. And then casters around the bottom of this thing. And a hole in the ground. And I think, oh, that's how it moves. Literally, you are doing that. Pushing this wretched thing. No wonder they only had like five. You know, I think it was about five Daleks in those days. And they just used to go round and round and round and round. So the camera would be filming this, you know, squadron of Daleks, never ending, you know, huge army of five Daleks actually just going round. It's quite amusing. That was great. Yeah. Shall I go on?
No, it's fine, it's fine. I mean, it's pretty impressive. So when you look at your father's either IMDb page or Wikipedia page, the amount of credits that he's got. I mean, I was trying to source some clips of kind of pre-Doctor Who from YouTube, but it's tricky, partly for the reason that you've just said, in that actually very little of this stuff survives.
Yeah.
I do have a little clip from... I think this was a TV adaptation of the Scarlet Pimpernel. It's not necessarily the clip I would have... chosen, given the choice of all the possible clips, but it was a...
Am I interrupted? Number four, business satisfactorily completed, and about time too. I've been playing cards with Jinzu. I lost my shirt!
Very funny.
Just an idea of your of a 1950s.
Gosh, he looks so young there. Sounds so young, dear me.
But then, into the 1960s, and again, if you look at the list of things that your father was in, it's kind of names that don't ring too many bells today, but certainly perhaps talking to those who are around there, TV programmes like Compact, Dr. Finley's Casebook, Zed Cars, just a whole list of the kind of programs that people were watching. Now, obviously you were too young at the time. Did he kind of share that perhaps was he looking for the big role to make his name, or was he just happy that he was an actor in work on TV and just kind of?
Yeah, he got a lot of work. As I said, all the way through his life, apart from 1976, he had the first of two hospitals. the second of which killed him in 87. And after the first heart attack, obviously, you know, he had to rest. And one of Dad's sort of besetting sins was overwork, which in a sense was brought on by the fact that acting is such an insecure career that, you know, who turns down a role? You know, you may not get another one if you turn the next one down. So it's a bit of a treadmill. And so he was forced to rest. But he then got, I think the very next part he got after the heart attack was in The Goodies as an alcoholic judge, something like that. So that was fine, and then it just, you know, kicked people sort of, oh, he's back, so, you know, he can start working again. But, yeah, he was in Zed Cars, meeting Stratford Johns and the Yorkshire Man. Not Brown Blessed, no. Stratford Johns was, they were in Softly, Softly together, and also in Zed Cars. Most of these guys, most of the great sort of actors like Jimmy Ellis, the Irish sergeant in Zed Cars, went on to, you know, greater things, but nearly all of them started in Zed Cars. You know, if you were any good, you were in Zed Cars. You know, it was like you had to cut your teeth in Zed Cars. So yeah, Dad did Zed Cars. He was a criminal. He played criminals, and he had to be a smoker. Now, Dad used to smoke very heavily in the war, gave it up, I think overnight because of health problems, and was offered this part where he had to be a heavy smoker. So what was he going to do? So he decided he would smoke herbal cigarettes. I'm not sure whether you can buy those anymore. Well, if you can, they're probably not very legal. But herbal cigarettes was the thing. So he was puffing away on these foul smelling herbal cigarettes. I remember that. Yeah, Zed Cars and all those sorts of things were, there would be lots of offers of small parts here and there. In those days, it was quite common, less so today, if you were in a major role, like Doctor Who, it was almost like not the done thing to be in anything else while you were doing that. So if it was Doctor Who, then you would also see him like you would see a David Tennant, for example, in another role, or the current James Bond will often be in other things as well as James Bond, you know. And people seem to accept that as perfectly okay. In Dad's days, that like wasn't, I don't know, it was just you didn't do that, you know, because it was too confusing for people, you know. I don't know. It's just weird, isn't it? It's just a different attitude. Perhaps you've got more wisdom on that one, I don't know.
Well, let's think about Doctor Who. I know you shared some stuff already. Now, 29th of October 1966, the end of the fourth episode of Doctor Who Adventure, the 10th Planet, something. We are really used to this, you know, however many times it's happened, but this would have been kind of
cutting
astonishing
edge.
to watch, and we've got it here, so. So that's William Hartnell, who played the first Doctor, turning into the second regeneration of the Doctor, your father. William Hartnell is quoted as saying there's only one man in England who can take over the role, and that's Patrick Troughton.
Gosh,
Do you know what led your father to take over the role? Did he share kind of how he managed to get the part?
I do. Right. It's not as sort of awe-inspiring as you might imagine. So the whole family, we were over in Ireland. Dad was filming in The Viking Queen, which was a sort of Viking versus Romans, sword and sandals sort of epic, with Nicola Paget in the role of the Viking Queen. I can't remember who else was in it, apart from Dad. But that was the first time I saw Dad die in the cinema. And that was quite traumatic. So Dad gets stabbed. And he dies on screen, you know, big sort of screen, and there I am, a little kid, seeing my dad die in front of me. That was pretty upsetting, actually. But then, you know, he had shown us the... we'd been to the studio at one location, and he'd shown me the clothes. He'd shown me the gash with the fake blood on it, so I could sort of, okay, it's not real, it's not real. Pull yourself together, it's not real, you know. So that was okay. But it was while he was filming that he got a phone call from his manager, Maurice Lambert, who said, I've got this new, you know, science fiction thing they're wondering whether to finish it because William Hartnell's sort of leaving, and they're offering it to you. What do you think? And Dad refused. He basically said, not interested, you know. It'll never take off. And Mum overheard the conversation, and she said, oh, don't be stupid, Patrick. It'll pay the children's school fees. So we were going to, you know, this grammar school, and that was sort of semi-private. There were scholarships and things.
No, I'm crackling.
My dad owes his career in Doctor Who to my mum, really. which is quite amusing. That's how that started.
And as a kind of, however old you were, 7 or 8 years old, that must be quite a big moment for you, for your father to take over the big kind of childhood Saturday evening hero. I mean, obviously changed his life, although he was obviously a big actor already at the time. Mm. Had an effect on your life in the playground.
Oh, definitely in the playground. So I was just beginning prep school, then going into the secondary school. So I was age 9, and Dad was already well known. So the school I went to, Latimer, actually did have quite a number of, you know, sort of media people's sons. It was a boys' school at it. So it wasn't odd. I didn't like sort of stick out like a sore thumb. I mean, there were other kids of, you know, actors, directors, writers, you know, media types, arty types at the school. So in a sense, you sort of fitted in. But, you know, having Dad who was Doctor Who was, obviously quite different. Teachers didn't treat me any specially, but you know, I'd be walking down the main corridor or in the school hall, and then some wiseacre, you know, from behind would go, you know, or exterminate was quite a common one. But I mean, you just shrug it off, don't you? It's quite cool, really. Dad was a great Francophile, so and he loved camping, so we used to go camping every summer because it was really inexpensive in those days. And we always go to France. He loved the French culture. Though his French was pretty appalling. And he'd always take the ferry because he was in the Navy in the war. So he loved the sea. Dover, Calais, no. He'd always go, you know, one of the longest crossings possible in order to enjoy the crossing. Thanks, Dad. And I remember one occasion when it was New Haven, Dieppe, which is, 4.5 hours, which is not that long, but it's long enough. And we're on the ferry, and I remember two things. One was, it was rough. You know, it was pretty rough. And I said to Dad, Dad, is this rough? And he looked at me and he said, flat as a mill pond, he said. I was like, yikes, what's rough then, you know? And the second thing I remember one of the crew coming down and coming up to Dad and saying, nice to have you on board, Mr. Tran. Would you like to come up to the bridge? So, yes, please. So we got to the bridge and, no, I wouldn't steer. I wasn't allowed to steer, but it was just quite fun, you know, seeing actually what the captain of the ferry could see. You know, it was good. Dad refused to sign autographs on holiday. So that was his stock reply. Sorry, I don't sign autographs, I'm on holiday. Bit of a killjoy. But so that was an obvious result of having a famous dad. Going swimming on Saturdays in Richmond. If Dad came with us, that was always quite interesting. You know. One thing that he did, one sort of devious tactic that he used to use to avoid being recognised in the street, he had one of his makeup artists lent him a sheikh's turban and a false beard and moustache. And so he used to occasionally go out looking like an Arab, because he's got this, you know, fairly sort of, you know, hooked nose and quite a, you know, tanned skin. So he, and very dark features, so he passes off pretty well actually as an Arab. So that was quite amusing. Avoidance, I think, is probably the thing that I most remember.
Well, let's remember a little bit, or perhaps watch for the first time some bits of your father's. We've got the title sequence used when your father was in the role, and then we've got a montage someone has put up on YouTube of some of the things, some of the bits of highlights of your father's. So let's just watch these. The way your father played Doctor Who was very different to William Hartnell. The mannerism, the characterisation, the props they used, you've got the recorder. How much of that was the fact that the scripts were changing? How much of that came from your father? How much of that came from actually who he was? You know what I mean? I mean, you told me
it's, it's always a negotiation between the actor and the director. So there's always a pooling of ideas, and in a sense the director is trying to, I think, probably put the lid on some of the enthusiasm of the actor, especially in my dad's case, and channel it and direct it, you know. But your dad was given quite a lot of freedom, I think, to develop it how he thought best. Two ideas he had at the beginning which were immediately clubbed on the head One was he was going to play it as a sort of a sea, you know, a sea captain, a sort of a, you know, a gnarled, you know, salty sea dog. Mm. That didn't go down very well. And the other, I think he was going to, you know, get himself blackened up and play it as some sort of.
If we all believe that didn't happen.
Yes. It's like what?
DVDs wouldn't sell.
You know, crazy man. So yeah, the I think the role developed along the lines of his own sense of humour. Mm. Sort of very serious 1 minute, and then sort of just breaking, you know, the tension with humour or a quip or a comment or a look. Mm. So a lot of the sort of serious stuff, I guess, would have been his Shakespeare training, the proper acting. And it's amazing how they speak in Doctor Who. Mm. I mean, the English tends to be very clipped, you know, a bit like Noel Coward speaking all the time, you know, very proper. Mm. And it's all quite posy, you know, when they're standing there, it's quite sort of theatrical. They don't relax much, you know. So I think Dad tended to sort of break away from that, and there was a lot more sort of, it was a lot more relaxed. Mm. He had great fun. I mean, he was forever mucking about on you know, location. Mm. Not as much as Peter Sellers, apparently. Peter Sellers was renowned for being really difficult to work with because he never took it seriously, you know. Mm. Constantly mucking about, you know, driving directors completely barmy. So Dad wasn't that bad, but yeah, so Charlie Chaplin, I guess, was one sort of model. And then the haircut was actually the Beatles, so he thought he'd poke fun at the Beatles and comb his hair forwards. Remember with the Beatles, the black and white LP cover, with them in black and white sort of half shadow? I think that was his inspiration for the haircut. So he thought he'd just, you know, sort of poke fun. And apparently the Beatles are great fans of Doctor Who, though I never managed to meet the Beatles, which is a bit of a shame. But yeah.
And the recorder was your inspiration, you were telling me just before we start.
Yeah, so this, I wish I'd kept hold of it actually, probably be worth a mint on eBay. But I'd started learning the recorder at age 7, and my brother had as well. And Dad was quite musical. I mean, he loved classical music, but he didn't play. But he thought it would be quite nice if, you know, the doctor had some sort of gimmick, apart from the hat and the baggy trousers. So he thought, I know what, I'll play tunes on my recorder occasionally. You know, problem, I can't play. Will you teach me? So I taught him how to play the recorder. And he picked up a few Irish jigs or something. And you know, there's occasional moments when he's playing, you know, the one tune that he knows.
And his era amongst fans is very kind of well thought of. A lot of the monsters, so you've mentioned the Daleks, the Yeti. We've got a picture of the Yeti there.
I was there on that location. I'm not in the shot, but I was very surprised to see a Yeti sipping a cup of tea with its head off, you know, and the bloke just. No, that's Wales. That's where that was filmed. Yeah.
Great. And then.
They frightened the wits out of me.
Presumably, you watched every Saturday, and as you,
without Dad, because it was mostly live. So that made it even more scary. I couldn't sort of say that's not real, is it, Dad? It's not real, is it? But yeah, I mean, the classic sort of cliche, almost, people hiding behind the sofa when the Daleks came on. It was bordering on the sort of horrific at times. Mm. Now, of course, it's, you know, probably gone even further than that. It was scary for children's entertainment.
Yeah.
Especially at 6 o'clock on a Saturday, it was like, whoa, this is a bit risque. But you get the impression that they're sort of pushing